This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Senator Jim DeMint is on the line with us. He is a United States Senator from South Carolina, Republican, and author, co-author of a new book, Why We Whisper, Restoring Our Right to Say It's Wrong. Senator DeMint, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Thank you for coming on. I've spent a fair amount of time with your book, and one of the things that baffles me, frankly, I don't know how to say it beyond that. Page 48, for example, 49, you say atheism and humanism, and speaking, let me just preface all this. Well, actually, I'll get to that. Atheism and humanism, beliefs that are that attach prime importance to human rather than divine ideals, are promoted when government says it is neutral toward religion. Now, as a Christian, I'm concerned about government being not neutral toward religion. I mean, I wouldn't want my government being taken over by, for example, a sect that is different than the one that I'm a member of. I've heard people express concern about five Catholics on the Supreme Court. I mean, why? It almost sounds like you're arguing for a religious test for government.
Oh, no, exactly the opposite. I think the government is pushing the religion of secularism now. We don't want the government to promote religion. But the problem we have is that values that have some association with religion have been eliminated from public policy development, even values that we know produce good outcomes, such as traditional marriage and families. I mean, we know that creates happier, healthier people, at children who are more adapted and with character and values. So what we're doing here is trying to make the distinction between what you said and that we don't want people in office pushing a religion, but we don't want values that are associated with religion excluded from the public debate.
But in your book, you say that if progressives can convince the judges and other government officials that there is such a thing as neutral policies, neutral in quotes, then it follows that only secularism will be supported by the state. Such an outcome will erode and then push into oblivion religious liberty in the United States. I looked up secularism in Merriam-Webster, the generic dictionary, probably one that we can all agree doesn't have any axe to grind. And it says not overtly or specifically religious, as in secular music, or not ecclesiastical or clerical, as in secular courts,
right,
or secular landowners. As far as I know, we have a secular government. The word God does not appear in the Constitution, and in fact, twice in the Constitution, in Article 6 and in the First Amendment, it says there shall be no religious test for government, and there shall be no official establishment of religion by government.
Well, let me just give you a few examples that are in the book that just point out the problem. The Boy Scouts, for instance, have God in their pledge. They've been sued for years by what we call paragovernment groups like the ACLU because they say there should be a separation of church and state. Now, this is a private organization that has been had to spend millions of dollars defending itself because of government policies and the complexity of government policies that are just unclear.
Well, what they've been defending is their tax-exempt status. It isn't like the ACLU said they shouldn't be in existence. You know, speaking as a former Boy Scout myself, and I have a lot of respect for the Boy Scouts, I read the chapter in your book about slap suits. Most slap suits, by the way, are by large corporations against whistleblowers. I'm sure you're familiar with that. But nonetheless, why should we? I mean, back in the day, I guess it was Lyndon Johnson did it. We made an agreement. We who believe that churches and hospitals and schools and communities for abused kids are such important things, such important social goods, that they meet such an essential need, that we're going to subsidize them. We're going to pay for their police, for their fire, for their roads. We're going to subsidize them by saying that they don't have to pay taxes. And the only thing that we ask that they do is not involve themselves in government.
Mm-hmm.
So why then, if if that's the case, why would you be arguing in favor of organizations involving, religious organizations involving themselves in government, or for that matter, government becoming more religious or grounded in religion?
Well, first, the Boy Scouts are not a government organization, and they have every right to set their own standards and put God in their pledge. And we should not have a system where they can be intimidated through our government policies. But let me give you a couple.
By and large, I don't disagree with you on that.
One of the most costly aspects of the decline in our culture are unwed births in this country. We spend $150 billion a year in government just for children from unwed births in this country. The government encourages that through subsidies, through the welfare system, through our tax code, through free health care. But if you actually get married and try to do it the right way, it's going to be much more expensive for you. You're going to have to pay your own health care. And what we're looking at in the book is we stay away from the idea of pushing religion, but we're saying that so many things like abstinence before marriage is a positive thing, but it's often thrown out of schools and contested because they say that's a religious value. It's not a religious value. In a country where you've got over a third of the kids being born out of wedlock, we've got a huge problem.
I've never heard that argument been made, and I've talked with the folks who are in favor of teaching birth control in our schools, and what they say is, let's teach abstinence and also teach birth control. And with regard to unwed births, why is it then that the countries that have far more of what you would probably refer to as socialism, you know, national health insurance, a much stronger social safety net, the Scandinavian countries, the Northern European countries, why is it that those countries have lower out-of-wedlock birth rates than we do? Why is it that they have dramatically lower infant mortality rates than we do? How can that be?
That's not necessarily true. If you look at Sweden and other countries, very few children are born in wedlock now. I mean, you've got a decline in marriage, and a lot of it goes back to government policies. But our challenge to folks is to recognize there is a cultural deterioration that is very costly in this country.
Why not? I agree with you. But it sure seems to me like that cultural deterioration is a consequence of poverty in the United States. We've got 12 to 14% of all Americans living in poverty. Isn't that just a total slap in the face of Christian values?
Certainly poverty is something we should try to fix. But if you look at the government's attempt to fix that, we have more poverty today, and a lot of the poverty programs were the programs that actually encouraged unwed births and expanded poverty and crime, youth violence, juvenile delinquency.
Lyndon Johnson cut poverty almost in half in four or five years.
There's more poverty today than there was when he started those programs, and there's also a lot of associated costs.
Well, there's more people today.
From families that have been destroyed by government policies that actually encouraged unwed births and single moms, and when fathers came back to the homes, they lost the money, they lost their Medicaid.
But in the book, you pointed out that we can't expect our schools to be doing this because the parents are working so many hours these days that they don't, you know, they come home, they don't have time to teach values to their kids. And that's the rationale that in the book that you put forward for the schools, which are government institutions, state institutions, teaching what you refer to as religious values.
We don't want government schools teaching religious values, but
values of abstinence, for example.
That's a common sense idea if you recognize.
I agree, and that's my point, is that everybody is saying we should be teaching abstinence, but what's wrong with also teaching birth control?
Well, I think what we're saying is parents should have the choice for sex to be taught in a moral context, and if parents don't want that a moral context, it's one thing, but in a government school. I mean, they have to, by default, basically there is no God, there are no values that are right or wrong, and basically teachers are afraid to teach a right or wrong. And to teach sex and marriage in the context of no values or morality has turned out to be a problem. So what we're not arguing a philosophy, but outcomes, that our government should look at what works for the best of the country and to be careful not to have policies that actually encourage destructive behavior. But we need to be encouraging those things through our policies that are good for the country. So not because they're religious, but because they work. And that's really the challenge of why we whisper is let's look at the cost of things. Let's look at what works. We don't want to promote religion, but at the same time, we don't want to throw out ideas that might have some religious association.
But the core premise here that you're suggesting is that religion is the source of morality. Thomas Jefferson, in an 1814 letter to Thomas Cooper, pointed out that he said Christianity was not introduced to England until the 7th century. The first conversion of the Christian king took place in 686. He said, hence, here was a space of 200 years during which the common law of England, which has become the common law of the United States, was in existence and Christianity no part of it. In truth, the alliance between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy. I mean, it's... would you like to stick around and continue this conversation?
Sure,
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
that,
if you're willing,
great. Stick around, because I'd like to get into, you know, this, and you were also promoting Cromwell and the Puritans, and I think we can have an interesting conversation here without it being too contentious. Thank you. Senator Jim DeMint is with us, the Republican senator from South Carolina. His new book, Why We Whisper, Restoring Our Right to Say It's Wrong.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
Oh, yeah. Here I am. All on up to it. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Senator Jim DeMint, the Republican from South Carolina. DeMint.Senate.gov is his website. His new book, Why We Whisper, Restoring Our Right to Say It's Wrong. A fascinating read and insight into Senator DeMint, and I think a lot of particularly Christian-grounded or religiously-grounded conservative perspective. Senator, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Tom. And let me mention, we do have a whywewhisper.com website, and we're going to encourage the type of questions and debate that you're talking about, which I think are excellent. And it's a debate, a national debate we need to have. And we're also encouraging folks to give us their stories.
Thank you.
If they've spoken out or if they've been intimidated, just go to whywewhisper.com and let us hear from you. And we hope to kind of compile all of this and let folks know what the country's thinking.
Yeah, and I agree with you, although we're probably in many cases, not in all, but in many cases on opposite sides of these issues. I think that there has been no national debate on this largely since the 50s, arguably maybe the 70s, but we really do need to be discussing these things. For example, on page 82 of your book, you correctly point out, and this is something I've been decrying for a long time, in a test of fourth graders, 60% did not know that the Pilgrims and Puritans came to America to practice religious freedom. The same percentage did not know that missions were the center of religious discovery and activities in the Spanish colonies. I would take it a step beyond that. The Puritans came to the United States because, you know, Oliver Cromwell overthrew the British monarchy and instituted a theocracy in England for, as I recall, 6 or 8 years in, what was it, 1635 or thereabouts. And the British were so horrified by the abuses. I mean, Cromwell then marched off to Ireland to murder Catholics. And in fact, from the official BBC website history of it, he gave the English an abiding suspicion of religious enthusiasm and created long-term instability in Ireland. That the Puritans were so vilified in that country. I mean, after Charles, I think it was Charles I. No, Charles I was the one he executed. In any case, the next king came along. They dug up his grave, posthumously executed him, put his head on a pike in front of Parliament for about a decade. The Puritans, and then the Puritans came to the United States and started hanging women as witches. I mean, shouldn't all that stuff be taught too?
Yeah, well, we should talk about the whole thing. And a distinction, Tom, that we have to make is values are important. Things are right and wrong. Some things, as far as behavior, work better for a society than others. And the whole point of civilization is to restrain a lot of our base instincts so that we can live together in peace and harmony. And we've got to decide what values that we believe in as a country. But I agree with you. The government cannot be pushing a particular religious doctrine. And I think a mistake some conservatives have made over the years is thinking if we elect some religious people that somehow that's going to help our country. That's not going to help our country if the government's pushing religion. But we don't. If a value is important and a value is shared by our country and it actually has better outcomes, we should not throw it out because there's a religious connection.
Now you just identified what I think is the major cleavage between conservatives and liberals historically. I mean, going all the way back to Thomas Hobbes and John Locke and certainly the founding of this country, largely the liberal founders of this country. And that is that conservatives believe that the purpose of government is to restrain us from our evil instincts. And liberals believe that the purpose of government is to lift us up so that we can achieve our highest potential.
Well,
and there's
right.
a significant difference in those two worldviews.
There are, and I think liberals tend to believe the government empowers. Conservatives tend to believe that people were born with inalienable rights and the government needs to protect those rights and to make sure we have a framework of law and order and justice. And there actually is more common ground than I think we discuss, because the liberal tendencies of helping people and helping the poor are things I was very involved with in the private sector. The problem has come if once we use the government as an instrument of compassion, we have seen very bad results, even though the intentions and the motivations are good. And what we just need to get folks to begin a national debate.
But why argue that it's grounded in religion? I mean, Thomas, the quote that I ended the last segment with from Jefferson. Jefferson was very outspoken. He was horribly offended by Patrick Henry, who wanted basically America to be a theocracy.
Right.
That Jefferson, among others, Madison, George Washington, all were very explicit that this country was not only not founded on religion or not founded on Christianity, but not founded on religion at all. That, you know, there's only two of the Ten Commandments that are in law right now in the United States. Now, thou shalt not kill and thou shalt not steal. Arguably, thou shalt not bear false witness. But it's actually not illegal to lie. It's only illegal to lie in court and, you know, to a police officer. So are you suggesting that in the absence of religion, people aren't intrinsically moral, that the tribal people around the world, the people of other religions around the world are not moral?
No, not at all. In fact, it's pretty clear that there's a common law written on the hearts of every human being. And what
you're paraphrasing Jefferson there.
Well, you're right, and it's also a biblical concept that.
But why promote it out of the Bible? Why not promote it secularly?
This book does not promote the Bible. But what we're saying is, if a value like marriage, it works, and the statistics related to encouraging marriage are so positive, why should we say that marriage is a religious value and the traditional marriage cannot be supported by public policy? And it's being thrown out because folks say it's religious, just like abstinence.
Yeah.
Or,
I get it. I'm sorry, sir, we're out of time, but your point is well made, and I appreciate you coming on. Senator Jim DeMint, his book is Why We Whisper, the website whywewhisper.com. Sir, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-302-2270. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Tom Hartman Program. Brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, letting them know that you're listening, letting your radio station know that you're listening, you like the program. And, of course, by SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Our telephone number, toll-free, 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com, our website, if you want to drop by, TomHartman.com. I'm going to put, during the next break, I'm going to put a link up there to just an extraordinary site that shows what happened when church and state got merged in another country in the last century. And some just a photo and a history of that. It'll take about probably 30 minutes for that to get up, but you can also comment at TomHartman.com on today's comments. Actually, Louise says she's going to be putting it up right away here in the next 10 minutes or so. We'll get it right off that front page, our front page blog at TomHartman.com. And also, if you want to drop into our live chat room, you can find a link there, as well as all of this also over at AirAmerica.com. 866-303-2270, our phone number. Paula in Carbondale, Illinois, listening on WINI, where we have been on the air for coming up on 6 years, I think, now. Hey, Paula, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I don't think you should let those religious people get away with saying that they get to define morality, because they're usually the same ones that are all about killing people in other countries, and they're all worried about saving fetuses here or forcing people to get married.
Yeah, well, you know, there really wasn't the time, unfortunately, to get into the conversation, you know, because I knew that, you know, when he was talking about marriage, that a lot of what he was talking about was code for, you know, gay marriage, that he was opposed to gay marriage and things like that.
Oh, I didn't even catch
but,
that.
Yeah, I'm guessing. But the fact of the matter is that I think that the folks on the right, like Senator DeMint, do have a point that we have a crisis. We have what is arguably a moral crisis in this country, and I would say all around the world, and probably it's always been a dimension of civilization. You read about the Roman Empire, you read about the Greeks. I mean, you know, Plato complained about such things 3,000 years ago. And the question is, the great question for government and the great question for us as citizens who participate with government is, how do we solve that? Do we solve it by teaching religious values and promoting those and making government more of a restraining force that holds us back from our evil impulses, which is, as I said, and I think the senator said, the conservative worldview? Or do we do that by saying, no, we're going to use government to make sure that none of us fall through those cracks, none of us fall through that safety net to the point where we are stealing for a living, where morality is or immorality is almost essential to life. I mean, when the Irish
well,
came
it
over
depends
here,
on what you call immoral. I don't think sex is immoral. I think killing is immoral.
Yeah.
And the reason he kept talking about welfare. Well, let me tell you this: I'm a baby boomer like you are, and I remember when girls got pregnant in the old days. They had to get married, which he, I guess, considers a wonderful thing. But what happened was the living wage could, you know, a boy could drop out of high school, go work at a gas station, make enough money to provide for the family. And now that is not possible, so families don't force their kids to get married anymore when they get pregnant.
Yeah, well,
you know,
that's my point.
They think it's cheaper for the government to pay welfare than it is for corporations to pay a living wage. Well, that's a choice that's been made, but I don't think it's by the government. I think it's by the big business.
Well, and that's the thing. Big business and all business operates within the rules that we define. And to back to the point that I was going to make is that when the Irish came here after the Great Potato Famine in the 1840s, and there was this huge influx of Irish who came during and after the American Civil War, they were viewed by most Americans. I mean, there were huge newspaper articles, a lot of speculation in the scientific press and like Scientific American kind of publications about what's genetically wrong with the Irish that they are predisposed to criminality. Because there were so many Irish in the big cities, particularly Boston, who would steal for food. And it was just, you know, oh, the Irish, they're just a criminal class. Well, 30 years later, 40 years later, 50 years later, in the 1880s and 1890s, as the second generation of Irish who were now Irish Americans were coming along, and they had actually gotten jobs, and they'd worked their way out of poverty, and they were something close to a middle class, or at least a working class, there was no longer that discussion. Instead, the discussion has shifted to, what's wrong with the Italians? They must be genetically, screwed up or criminal, because look at all the Italian, because there's this big wave of Italian immigration in the 1880s and 1890s. And the bottom line is that it's poverty that drives these things. And my argument is that what we need to do is we need to address poverty. We do that structurally. We don't do it by wagging our finger at people and telling them to be moral. And
well,
Paula,
except for the very, very rich, they're immoral, and they do it generation after generation.
Yeah.
You know, they steal for third houses and private jets. So there's something wrong with them, I guess.
Yep, well said. Paula, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to us there in Carbondale. Shannon in Minnesota. Hey, Shannon, what's up?
Not a lot. Paula stole most of my thunder, but I see red when I hear these religionists, and that's what I consider this guy. He's a religionist. I see red when I hear him talk about how, one, social programs are causing poverty. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. What causes poverty is Ronald Reagan and his ilk. And
well, what causes poverty is government saying that we're going to define the rules of the game of business, which is necessary. You have to, you know, you have courts and you have rules and all that. And saying that one of the rules of business that we're going to define is that it is okay to employ somebody for what is essentially slave wages, you know, slave labor wages. And that you cannot live on, it is immoral in the United States that anybody work at a wage that they can't live at. I mean, that's simply wrong.
Absolutely.
There was a study done a couple of years ago that people who work at Walmart, if they bought 100% of their food and clothing and everything they needed from Walmart, and it's all available in the big ones, you know, that they couldn't afford to live, they couldn't afford to buy the stuff from Walmart in order to support their family. You know, it's just wrong. Shannon, thank you.
The thing that gets me, though, is I got this email saying that, well, because there's no prayer in school, that's why our schools are falling apart.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this idea that, this post hoc, ergo propter hoc idea that because we're not following these religious precepts, that is why we're having the social breakdown,
right,
or the moral crisis. And what's this thing about Cromwell? Cromwell was the Hitler of the Irish people.
I know, that's the point that I made. And he's like, why don't we teach our kids that the Puritans came here and they were wonderful religious people? And I'm like, the Puritans came here because the British drove them out of the country because they banned dancing, because they killed, they murdered all these Catholics in Ireland. And I know that I'm going to get a bunch of Brits who are going to call up and go, oh, no, wait a minute, Cromwell's a great hero. In fact, Friday, Louise and I walked by Parliament, and there was the statue of our Oliver Cromwell. He's still considered one of the top 10, you know, in British history, one of the leading 10 positively viewed statesmen, but you know, history is arguably 300 years later here still out on that. Michael, thank you for the call. Michael in Los Angeles. Hey, Michael.
Hi. I didn't know that he was talking about base impulses as being evil. You know, hunger, shelter, health, feeling healthy, income, and even justice are the most base of basic instincts of all peoples, and the Republicans are obsessed on repressing those instincts. On the other hand, how are they restraining the commercial instincts of people like Enron, Exxon, Countrywide? The list is endless.
Yeah, well, I don't know Senator DeMint's voting record, so I don't think we can, he's not here to defend himself on that.
But I mean,
but your point, broadly speaking,
sex isn't the only impulse that people have.
Yeah, no, in fact, I would say probably the most destructive impulse that people have in our society is not sex, but it's greed. And Michael, you put your finger on it. Thank you very much. Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey. Hey, Richard.
Yeah, hi. I just was wondering, Exxon, you know, talking about greed, they've made the biggest profits in history and have yet to pay for the fine for the Valdez.
Well, they just wiggled out of that in a court case a couple of months ago, didn't they?
I don't know. I'm just wondering about that because I heard something about it. But, you know, they're making $34 billion a year, and they haven't paid the $7 billion fine. And it's 10 years or more. How are they getting away with that? Also, too, that about the Puritans. They also executed non-Puritans for being non-Puritans, I think.
Oh, in particular, the Quakers.
A dozen or 24 Quakers were executed because they wouldn't give up their hungers. They wouldn't give up their religion.
Oh, and Patrick Henry, you know, wanted I forget which state it was. I think it was Pennsylvania. It might have been Virginia, but he wanted the entire state to exclude Quakers, to make it illegal to be a Quaker. I mean,
but the irony, though, is there's a statue of Cromwell at the British Parliament.
Right.
Didn't he ban the British Parliament for 10 years? It didn't meet.
I frankly don't know. He was the Lord Protector.
Parliament for that period of time too.
Yeah,
that's irony of ironies.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Richard. I'm not enough of a scholar on British history to give the details of that. I believe that Parliament was meeting during that time, and it was actually viewed as a time of greater democracy than the kingdoms that preceded it. And in many ways, it set up greater democracy following it. But, you know, I don't profess to be an expert on Cromwell. Julie in Seattle. Hey, Julie, got about a half a minute here before the next break.
Okay, Tom, I just find it interesting that the religious right, after 30 years of ascendancy for quote-unquote religious-oriented politics, from candidates from Carter up to the present day where we endured Romney's speech, where apparently atheism, which I hold, is not an option, that there's still...
What, Julie? Julie, you're breaking up.
Oh, I said that they still advance themselves as some sort of victims of a secular society.
Yeah, it is.
It's amazing. They've had plenty of time for their experiment.
It is rather odd that they present themselves as victims. And at the same time, that so many of them, like Pat Robertson, I mean, he's become a billionaire on our backs, on tax-free religion. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
Oh, brother, I can't get through.
No, it is.
Well, maybe it's not.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. What I know is that democracy is returning to America after a substantial absence, and that we're seeing a correction right now in the marketplace that is showing the core weaknesses of this country that track back to Ronald Reagan and Reagan's policies, arguably to Jimmy Carter's deregulation, the beginning of deregulation, Reagan putting it on steroids, Bush Sr. following through with it, Clinton kicking open the doors to international purchasing of America and international outsourcing of labor, NAFTA and WTO and GATT and all that sort of thing. And then Bush Jr. putting Clinton stuff on steroids. And so what we have is a corporatocracy. We no longer have a democracy. I mean, that's where we're at. And the corporatocracies, as they did in 1929, they collapse. And it's in the process of collapsing right now. And frankly, I think that ultimately it's going to be a good thing. We'll see how it shakes out. Randy in Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's on your mind today?
Hi. It was the last hour, the comment about what to do about religion in government.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that is that they're so divisive in their beliefs that they can't agree on one objective. And for them to fall under welfare from the state, getting the faith-based initiative money, shouldn't they have to stand the test of law, being they're seeking power through the law?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely unconstitutional, the entire faith-based initiative thing. The James Madison, the fourth president of the United States, his first veto was to veto, and it may have been his only, but in any case, it was his first veto in office, and it was his first year in office. His first veto was to veto a bill that gave public money, federal money, to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor. He said, this is a secular function, this is a secular government, we should not be giving money to churches because it will corrupt the church. He was a Christian, and he was very concerned about his religion being corrupted by federal money. And he said, you know, create a home for the poor, give them food, no problem, but don't involve the church in the process. And he vetoed that bill. And that was the position of this country for a long, long time. And the faith-based initiative program actually was started under Clinton. But again, it went on steroids under George W. Bush. And it has not been a good thing, frankly. I don't think it's been a good thing for religion. I don't think it's been a good thing for government. I don't think it's been a good thing for America. Randy, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. Jack in California. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you know, what really gets me is when I hear guys like this, I don't have a problem with them at first, and then all of a sudden I wonder to myself, where are they when it comes to torture techniques? I mean, Guantanamo and things like this. You know, people have been tortured. Innocent people have been tortured.
Well, there are some Republicans who are speaking out about that. John McCain, probably the most prominent. I don't know Jim DeMint's positions. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Rudy Giuliani, during one of the debates, was quoted saying that I would tell people who had to do the interrogation to use every method they could.
Oh, make. I know. Jack, Rudy Giuliani is a thug. He's just a thug. There's no other way to say it. But, you know, to say that because somebody is a Republican or because they're conservative, then therefore they're in favor of torture. Yeah, the Republicans, by and large, are trying to cover the backside of George W. Bush. They don't want the prosecutions. They don't want the impeachment. They don't want to be held accountable. But I think that there are a number of Republicans who are honorable and ethical people, at least in that context, you know, and probably in a few others. But I don't know Jim DeMint's position on that, so I don't think that we can pick on him for that. Let's keep this to the issue that it was. Larry in Illinois. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
That senator, he don't take in the fact that these poor people are working the system. They can't even afford to get married because how do they pay for a child being born? They don't have any insurance.
Yeah.
And same with abortion. I'm Catholic, you know, and abortion down in Grand City, Illinois, costs $340. And if you don't have no health insurance, how are you going to pay the average $8,800 hospital bill for a child?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Larry. That's a great argument for national health care. You want to stop abortions right now or reduce the number of abortions? Have national health care that covers all obstetrics and gynecological stuff, and including childbirth. Very good point, Larry. Thank you very much, Rich in Connecticut. Hey, Rich.
Hi. The problem with the religious-based societies is if you look at Iran or Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan under the Taliban, their economies were in the toilet. I mean, you take away oil from Iran, they would collapse within a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, in other words, what happens when the religious, in quotes, take over a government, when you have theocracies, is that the government goes into the tank. And we've seen that over and over and over and over again. And I'd argue that that may have been even one of the things that led to the fall of the Roman Empire, but that's a whole other argument. Thank you for your point. Kat in Virginia, you want to correct my dates on Cromwell?
Hi, Tom. Cromwell was absolutely a tyrant, but the Puritans came over here in 1620. Before Cromwell was in power. He rose to power 10 years later, and he led the parliamentary forces against Charles I, whom he had executed in 1649. Then he was the head of the Commonwealth until 1660. That's the only reason there's a statue to him in front of Parliament was because he led the parliamentary forces, and he encouraged an actual Parliament without a monarch. But he became a tyrant, and that's why he's so reviled, was because he became exactly the same kind of tyrant that Charles I had been. And he was dug up and his body was re-executed in 1660. But the Puritans who came here were extremists, and the English recognized that and threw them out of England long before Cromwell. He just made it worse.
Right, and Cromwell was just another one of them, and he was following down that same road. Okay, thank you for the correction of the order, but the point is still, I think, well taken, is that the Puritans who came here were not these, you know, sweet Christians who were suffering persecution. They were the ones who wanted to persecute because they wanted to run England, and they ultimately did under Cromwell.
Right. It was a disaster, and everybody hated them because of the draconian rules they put into place. And when they got here, they made things worse for the other people in Massachusetts Bay Colony.
Yeah, well said. Kat, thank you very much. It's so much of our history that, it's like, God, Jim DeMint is right. We don't teach history in our school. Now comes the question, what history are we going to teach? 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up next, what's the legacy, the real legacy of Ronald Reagan?
The Tom Hartman program.
Tom Hartman.
Where smart people get their news. Tom Hartman program.
Tom Hartman.
Where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Teddy Roosevelt, 1913, talking to the Progressive Boys Club of New York City. Just talking about the square deal. This is interesting.
The principles for which we stand are the principles of fair play and a square deal for every man and every woman in the United States. A square deal politically, a square deal in matters social and industrial. I wish to see you boys join the Progressive Party and act in that party and as good citizens, in the same way I'd expect any one of you to act in a football game. In other words, don't flinch, don't foul, and hit the line hard.
There you go. The former Republican president of the United States of America. Yes, let's be progressive. Let's have a square deal for workers. Let's have a square deal for the average people in the United States. John McCain, right now, who in I've been predicting all along is going to be the Republican nominee. I think, frankly, he's all they've got left. I mean, time will tell. It's possible Mitt Romney can write another check, a couple more checks, and end up the nominee. If so, great, from my point of view. He'll be very easy to beat. But John McCain, I think, frankly, is going to be tough to beat for a Democrat. And therefore, and I think the Republicans are figuring this out and figuring it out very quickly. John McCain on the economy. And this is where the Republicans really are weak. Because the Republican philosophy on the economy has always been, ever since the 1880s, when the party was hijacked by the railroad barons and lost its progressive roots from its founding in 1856 and then its first serious presidential candidate, Abraham Lincoln, You know, there was about a 20, 30-year period there where the Republican Party was the Reform and the Progressive Party, and then it became, in the 1880s, the Party of Big Business, and it has been ever since. And, in fact, there are some who say that, you know, since 2000, when they flipped the stars upside down on the GOP elephant, it has even become the Party of Satan. I would not go so far as to say that, although I still am wondering why those stars were flipped upside down. In any case, John McCain, the guy who is their candidate, or who probably will be their candidate, is out there saying, I still believe our fundamental underpinnings of our economy are strong. Yeah. And we also have, you know, I mean, George Bush saying the same things. I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling. And the reality is that the fundamental underpinnings of the United States, the U.S. economy, are not strong. They're disastrous, in large part because of policies put in place by Ronald Reagan, the guy who initiated the rollback of the New Deal. Robert Perry's on the line with us. Robert is one of America's best investigative reporters, writes over consortiumnews.com. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Recently, and thank you for being here, and we're going to have a break in about 6 minutes. I hope you can stick around. We can carry it over into the,
sure,
into the next segment as well, because you've written just an absolutely brilliant piece. Recently, Barack Obama referred to Ronald Reagan as an agent of change, or phrases to that. You said he, quote, changed the trajectory of America. That's true. It's absolutely true. And setting aside the, you know, the Obama-Clinton squabble about whether or not a Democrat should invoke Reagan's name, you have written an absolutely brilliant piece laying out the true legacy of Ronald Reagan. And I thought rather than my going through and just hitting the talking points on it, I wanted to bring you on to do it. First of all, you're a smart, articulate guy. And secondly, I mean, you did the research. You deserve the credit for it. So give us this shot here. Who really was Ronald Reagan, and what did he do to the United States?
Well, Ronald Reagan was the guy, as you mentioned, Tom, who started this trajectory of the United States moving away from the New Deal, away from this idea of building a middle class, which followed World War II, and increasingly toward a winners and losers kind of culture, where the very wealthiest got the most rewards, and the average folk got less and less. And that was part of what Reagan did on the domestic side. On the foreign policy side, he really began what we now view as sort of the neoconservative movement, where he credentialed many of the neoconservatives, people like Elliot Abrams, and brought them in and gave them key jobs. And they practiced much what we see now, initially on Central America, which I was covering back in the 1980s for the Associated Press. And what occurred there was, first of all, a totally immoral, horrid slaughtering of peasants, labor leaders, working people of all sorts by right-wing governments that wanted to maintain the kind of privilege that the wealthiest had in that area. It was very disproportionate in terms of who held the wealth and power in places like Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador. So you had the Reagan administration coming in, imposing sort of a Cold War template on Central America, and then supporting some of these very ruthless death squad operations, where literally tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people were killed.
And we weren't just doing this in Central and South America. We were doing this in the Middle East as well.
We were doing it also in Africa. There was this.
Yeah.
It was in this context of
Southeast Asia. We were doing it all over.
We were basically doing it all over. But on top of what was actually happening, there was this idea of perception management, mm-hmm, which the neoconservatives brought in, which was if they could control how Americans perceived these events, that is, if they could suppress the horrible news and get the reporters not to tell those stories, at least not very much, and punish the reporters who did, that they could, in effect, control how Americans saw these events and therefore get the American people to back things that they might not back if they knew the full story.
Robert,
so
you
it was
mentioned
kind of a full, it was kind of a full effort to begin what we now see today, which is how do you get Americans to support things that are quite outrageous,
that are anti-American,
right,
essentially. You mentioned the neoconservatives. To what extent do you think that Mr. Strauss, the founder of the neoconservatives, and his suggestion that it's okay to lie in the service of a larger good, a greater good, and Leo Strauss, and his many students, you know, Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, many of the people who he was their mentor. To what extent do you think that notion influenced Reagan, or was it simply part of the zeitgeist?
Well, I think Reagan understood the need to present things in a very in a way that was palatable for the American people. He was very good at that, obviously.
Right.
He'd spent the time as GE Theater. He'd been on the
talk, on the
speaking circuit. He knew how to touch Americans, pull our strings, and get us to support various things. He knew how to present stuff. But he was an ad man in many ways, as well as an actor. So you had that. But on the case of the neoconservatives, they were influenced by Strauss, who was this professor back at the University of Chicago. But they also, many of them also came out, at least their parents and their families came out of more of a Trotskyite far left position, which also looked at this idea of a vanguard party. And the neocon,
the ends justify the means.
Right. The neocons saw themselves essentially the vanguard. They knew what was best for the United States. They had to get the American people, the proletariat, I guess you might say, in a different context, to sort of follow them.
Right.
So it was always, how do you manipulate the information to get the American people to follow you? And it was essentially and fundamentally anti-democratic.
Yeah, small-d democratic. Right. And they're still doing that. I mean, Ronald Reagan, now here's Reagan telling a joke, right?
Yet any time you and I question the schemes of the do-gooders, we're denounced as being against their humanitarian goal. They say we're always against things, we're never for anything. Well, the trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so. Now,
and he would, you know, he'd just kind of pull these things out that didn't mean or say anything, but, you know, just worked.
Right. There was this up is down quality, which we also see these days, where they almost present the opposite of reality and get away with it. And the piece you talked about that I wrote for ConsortiumNews.com about what actually happened in Central America goes through what was actually happening in Guatemala, which we now know a great deal about because the documents have been released, and what the U.S. government knew about even the genocide that was being conducted against some of the Mayan Indians in the highlands there,
right.
and how Reagan was able to cover that up, and how the neocons were able to spin this in ways so the American people never got a real full understanding of what was being done in their names.
We're talking with Robert Perry, American investigative journalist with Consortium News, consortiumnews.com. And Robert, when we come back, I'd like to play a clip from Ronald Reagan in support of Harry Truman when he was a Democrat and get your take on how he moved from being a Democrat to being a Republican and what that meant for America and you know, how we ended up where we are. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Yeah, new direction like Ronald Reagan was what? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Robert Perry of ConsortiumNews.com. As a brilliant article that he's written about the war crimes that were committed by Ronald Reagan, sanctioned by Ronald Reagan, and from, you know, skulls as candle holders, this massive genocide down in Central America. And Robert, if you don't mind, I've got about a minute and a half here long commercial that Ronald Reagan did back when he was a Democrat. And if I may play this for you and get your take on what happened after that.
Okay, sure.
Okay, great. Here it is. Let me turn it up first.
The profits of corporations have doubled, while workers' wages have increased by only one quarter. In other words, profits have gone up four times as much as wages. And the small increase workers did receive was more than eaten up by rising prices, which have also bored into their savings. For example, here's an Associated Press dispatch I read the other day about Smith L. Carpenter, a craftsman in Union Springs, New York. Seems that Mr. Carpenter retired some years ago, thinking he had enough money saved up so that he could live out his last years without having to worry. But he didn't figure on this Republican inflation, which ate up all his savings, and so he's gone back to work. The reason this is news is Mr. Carpenter is 91 years old. Now, take as a contrast the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which reported a net profit of $210 million after taxes for the first half of 1948, an increase of 70% in 1 year. In other words, high prices have not been caused by higher wages, but by bigger and bigger profits. The Republican promises sounded pretty good in 1946. But what has happened since then, since the 80th Congress took over? Prices have climbed to the highest level in history, although the death of the OPA was supposed to bring prices down through, quote, the natural process of free competition, unquote. Labor has been handcuffed by the vicious Taft-Hartley law. Social Security benefits have been snatched away from almost 1 million workers by the Gearhart bill. Fair employment practices, which had worked so well during wartime, have been abandoned. Veterans' pleas for low-cost homes have been ignored, and many people are still living in made-over chicken coops and garages. Tax reduction bills have been passed to benefit the higher income brackets alone. The average worker saved only $1.73 a week. In the false name of economy, millions of children have been deprived of milk once provided through the federal school lunch program. This was the payoff of the Republicans' promises. And this is why we must have new faces in the Congress of the United States, Democratic faces. This is why we must elect not only President Truman, but also men like Mayor Hubert Humphrey of Minneapolis, the Democratic candidate for senator from Minnesota.
This is an ad that Reagan did in dozens of cities around the United States for local mayors and for gubernatorial races. He was a very aggressive Democratic campaigner. And then he became a Republican president, and then, as you so eloquently point out in your article over at consortiumnews.com, arguably became one of our worst war criminal presidents. What happened?
Well, it's a hard thing to always know what goes on in a person's mind. I think politics and power and money, a lot of things influence the direction of anyone as they go through their life. And I think Reagan became someone who went to work for the General Electric Corporation, as we all know. He hosted GE Theater, and he also gave speeches around the country on behalf of the corporation. And over time, became one of them, in the sense that he saw his position as enhanced by that kind of.
Well, Nancy's father
was
viewpoint. Was very big in bringing him into this, wasn't?
What's that?
His second wife, Nancy's father, was very big in bringing him into the Republican fold, as I recall.
Right, there were personal influences too.
But I guess the larger question is, to what extent were the crimes that were committed during the Reagan administration? Because I think there's fairly good evidence that at least during the last 2 years of Reagan's administration, of his 8 years, that he was gone. His Alzheimer's was so bad he wasn't. There was nobody home. And George Bush was running the country, George Herbert Walker Bush. To what extent was this genocide in Central and South America Reagan's fault versus George Herbert Walker Bush's fault, the former director of the CIA?
Well, they both should take a lot of blame for it. But Reagan was much more attentive and knowledgeable about what was going on in Central America than many people understand.
Hmm.
It was something that he was interested in. It is true he would phase out when it came to the budget or something like that, but when it came to some of these wars that were going on, which he saw as part of the Cold War, but in a sense they really weren't. They were very much local struggles between haves and haves, not have-nots in these little countries. But he would take a great deal of interest. He knew in great detail what was going on with the Contras, for instance, in Nicaragua. And he had a realistic view of them. Now, I quote, there was a reference in Dewey Claridge's book. He was one of the CIA officers in charge of the Contras. And at one point when Reagan wanted something done, he turned to Dewey and said, "Can't your vandals take care of it?" So he referred to the Contras as vandals in private, although when he talked to the American people, they were the moral equals of the founding fathers and
right.
freedom fighters.
Robert, we got about 20 seconds left. Any chance that Reagan can be held to account for his war crimes?
Well, I think it would be great at some point for the United States to have a truth commission, much like we've seen happen in South Africa and Argentina and many other places. And that was something I fault Bill Clinton for when he took over the first president after the Cold War,
right.
and he didn't do anything really on that. So, but it's still something that should happen.
And you suggest that now is an opportunity for people like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton to be talking about the true legacy of Ronald Reagan.
Right, instead of pretending that it was all sweetness and light.
Yeah, that he was just a good guy, but he was a Republican. Horrible thing. Robert Perry, ConsortiumNews.com. The article is called "Obama's Dubious Praise for Reagan." Strongly recommended reading. Robert, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, or telephone number, TomHartman.com, or website.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Radio.
are back, 34 minutes past the hour. Some strange news out there. This is one dizzy cat, I'll tell you. This is our Higgins alert. And the last time cat owner, this is amazing, last time cat owner Kelly Levy saw her tiger-striped feline was before she took her husband to the airport. 24-year-old came back to her house late Friday to find the bottom step where Gracie May, the cat, would usually be waiting, empty. Tore the house apart. Freaked out. Papered the newspaper, the neighborhood with lost cat signs. Then she gets a phone call. Hi, you're not going to believe this, but I'm calling from Fort Worth, Texas, and I accidentally picked up your husband's luggage, and when I opened the luggage, a cat jumped out. Levy recalled the caller saying, the South Florida Sun Sentinel reported. Rob Carter of Fort Worth, Texas, told the Dallas Morning News that he'd made it home with a suitcase. He said, I went to unpack and saw some of the clothes and realized it wasn't my suitcase. I was going to close it, and a kitten jumped out and ran under the bed. I screamed like a little girl. Carter delivered Gracie May to the Seth Levy, and the tabby made the 1,300-mile trip home on an $80 plane ticket Sunday night. Yeah. One time, when we lived in rural Vermont, we lived way out in the woods in the middle of nowhere, and I had to give a speech in Burlington, which was about an hour and a half drive away, and I got in the car and drove to Burlington, and all the way there I kept hearing the sound. It sounded like a cat meowing, and I thought, this is so weird. You know, it was faint, and I thought maybe it was like a fan belt that was loose that was making that sound, or maybe I was imagining it or something. But finally, when I got to Burlington, when there wasn't all that road noise, when I slowed down, I could hear it quite loudly. And so within a half mile or so of getting off the highway, I stopped at my friend's house who was, he was going with me to this talk. I was this book signing and talk I was doing. And then afterwards, we were going to go back to his house and have dinner. I stopped and I could hear it coming from under my hood. I opened the hood of my car and there was one of our cats. It wasn't Higgins. It was a cat we had called Java, a Maine Coon cat, sitting just behind the battery over the wheel well, all disheveled. But he was fine, although he was pretty badly dehydrated. I took him. Now, here's what was amazing. I walked up to the front door of Alan's house, knocked on the door. You know, Alan opens the door. I got this cat in my hand. I said, you know, I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. Instead of coming with me to the book signing and the talk, can you take my cat to the vet while I'm there or find one? And he said, well, just by coincidence, my sister and brother-in-law are here. My brother-in-law is a vet. And so we walked into the living room, and there was a veterinarian. And he said, oh, I'll take care of your cat while you and Alan go to the book signing. Not to worry. And when we came back 2 hours later, Java, our cat, was in fine shape, all cleaned up, well rehydrated, and although never quite pleased with the idea of getting in or near a car after that. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see, Diane in Berkeley, California. Hey, Diane, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I have a story about Reagan that's sort of a timeline story. Can you hear me?
Sure, I can. Yeah.
My husband and I met on a plane going to Sacramento, sponsored by ACLU, back in 1959. We were going to try to get the lettering oath, which was an anti-disloyalty disclaimer oath that all teachers had to take to get it repealed.
Mm-hmm.
And the first date that my husband asked me on was to a United World Federalist dinner a few weeks from the trip, and Ronald Reagan was to be the guest speaker. Now, if you know anything about United World Federalists,
they were like the socialists of their day, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, by the time the dinner occurred, he had canceled and become a Republican.
Oh, really?
That was 1959. And I have
to
say that now, every time I see a homeless person on the street, I think that's Ronald Reagan's legacy.
Well, it really is. You know, you and I are old enough to remember, perhaps you're a little older than I am, but we're both old enough to remember when there weren't homeless people on the streets
of the
United States.
Right.
And it happened after the third or fourth year of the Reagan presidency, when he cut all the funding to mental hospitals and
exactly.
Basically turned people out on the streets.
Right.
And
well, I just thank you for continuing to puncture the myth about him.
Yeah, thank you very much. We need to do that on an ongoing basis. I appreciate the call, Dan. Thank you. John in San Diego, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hello there. Yes, the Reagan taxes, I think he was the first to cut taxes for the wealthy, and he also doubled the Social Security tax and doubled it again by creating the payroll tax. Is that right?
Well, he didn't create the payroll tax. It was already there, the Social Security tax. But what he did was he doubled the Social Security tax. It was the largest tax. Ronald Reagan passed the largest tax increase in the history of the United States. And it was a tax increase 100% of which fell on people who made less than $50,000 a year. 100% of it. At the same time, he also cut taxes on millionaires and billionaires from a top, for people who earned in today's dollars over $3.2 million, from a top rate of 71% down to a top rate of 28%. So that's what Reagan did, and that began the absolute landslide. You know, talk about a slow slide. No, this was a landslide into converting the middle class into the working poor in the United States, and now we have 12% of the U.S. population living at or below the poverty line. I mean, this is a moral disaster. It's absolutely incredible. But that's what Reagan did. John, thanks a lot for the call. Alan in New York City. Hey, Alan.
Yes, Tom. I'm calling to ask you, what is your campaign strategy for John Edwards? Because from what I'm hearing from you, it seems like you just keep bashing Barack Obama. Every chance that you get, you read articles that talks about all he's vulnerable. You get people on your show to even legitimize a lot of these things. And I have listened to you telling people that they ought not to vote for Kucinich because he makes a deal with Obama. I don't think these things are right.
All right. Well, I understand your disagreement with me. I will say this again. All three of the Republican candidates who are the leading Republican candidates right now have vulnerabilities. All three of them. Edwards' biggest vulnerabilities are his voting record in the Senate and his perception as the guy who gets expensive haircuts.
But you don't talk about these things. You don't talk about his voting records at all. And you're quick to defend him at all times.
Well, I'm sorry if it seems like I'm an absolute Edwards partisan. I try very hard and probably more so than I need to, but I frankly think it should not be my job to wound any of the candidates, and I don't intend to. But I'm telling you, as I said, those are the areas where they will go after Edwards, where they will go after Hillary Clinton is on her voting record and her being a woman. And don't, you know, for a minute think that you're not going to hear, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, you're not going to hear the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox ads rolled out again from Rush Limbaugh, for example.
Ladies, are you fed up with men calling the shots? Are you looking for a new weapon in the war of the sexes? If you need the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox, you can...
And he goes on, you know, goes on from there. So there's going to be misogyny or sexism used against Hillary Clinton. And if Barack Obama is the candidate, there's going to be racism. And the fact that his middle name is Hussein, they're going to be arguing that he's a Muslim, is going to be used against him. All three of them are going to be attacked viciously. Any one of the three of them are going to be attacked viciously by the Republicans. We have to acknowledge that. I think we need to talk about that. We need to be prepared for it. I think it's great that Barack Obama, over on his website right now, is talking back to this viral email that's been going around saying that he's a secret part of some Muslim conspiracy to take over America, because it's a lie. It's a flaming lie. And the guy's been the member of the same Christian church for over 20 years. And so now there's another one going out, oh, he's part of some sort of a black supremacist Christian church. Well, that's a lie, too. I mean, there are so many lies about Barack Obama out there, and I'm glad that he's fighting back on them. And you know, as I've said a couple of times, Hillary Clinton's, you know, people say, oh, they're fighting with each other, Obama and Clinton. I think that's great. That shows that they can fight against a Republican as well. Anyhow, Jason in Los Angeles. Hey, Jason.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to talk about for a second Martin Luther King III's letter to John Edwards. I don't know if you talked about it yesterday.
I actually read it on the air yesterday.
Oh, fantastic. I really think it's important because the mainstream media does not talk about this. And, in fact, even in that debate, the other night on CNN, they seem to want to say somehow that Martin Luther King would have endorsed Senator Obama. And I think that Martin Luther King III's letter really got to the point of what Dr. King's message is, which is that he fought for injustice and against poverty, and John Edwards is really the only one that's talking about these issues. And I just
I believe that all three of them have what it takes to take on some of these issues. Although you're right, Edwards has made it the core of his campaign from day one, and for basically for his lifetime. And although, you know, Barack Obama did too. I mean, you know, he was organizing, campaigning on the south side of Chicago, as he points out. He's worked very, very hard against poverty. And Hillary Clinton, you know, arguably has done so, although I would say that her husband's policies in ending welfare as we know it have actually made the problem of poverty in the United States worse. I don't believe that it was a good thing. But, you know, she's not campaigning on, well, sometimes she's not campaigning on her husband's policies. Jason, thanks for the call. What can I say? 45 minutes. It's going to be a wild ride to Super Tuesday, and we'll see what comes out of that. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Here's another song from GW. That's me and the Carlisle Group. Here we go. Get real close. Strangers in the night, exchanging gunfire. Liberals so uptight, call me a liar. Challenging my war before my term is through. Something in their eyes is getting scary. Keeping to my plan is getting hairy. Every day it's hard to do the things I do. Justify my fight. Please, Limbaugh, Hannity, O'Reilly on the right. My agenda on the burner's burning bright. Because I'm so uptight, demonize the left today and take their right to speak away. And if you all succeed, we'll satisfy your hunger and your greed with all the corporate dollars that you need. And some pretty little strangers in the night.
Yes. Thank you, George. Thank you so much. Yes.
All those clowns over at the Liberal Radio Network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please?
Who let
Send
him
over
in
to
here?
The FBI and just put them in chains?
Get out of here! Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you, by the way, in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Brian in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
A lot, Tom. I have one question for I want to ask you. Do you really seriously think Hillary Clinton will be any different from what we have seen in the past? We have gone through Reagan, then we go through Bush, then we go through Clinton, and now we go through Bush, and then we go through Clinton again. Do you think she's going to be anything different? The way our president is walking around this country speaking?
Yeah, I think so. And the reason why I think so, Brian, is because the times are different. When Bill Clinton came into office, Bill Clinton was elected on a progressive platform, which demonstrates that progressive politics still work in the United States. He was sat down 2 weeks before he went into office by as I recall, Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan, and told the facts of life, you know, sorry, son, you're not going to be able to govern as a progressive. And he governed basically as a moderate Republican. And you know, times were good. You know, economically, times were good during the Clinton administration. And so most people who were politically active basically went to sleep. You know, people were out there making money. They were raising kids. They were doing other things. They weren't doing politics. And this war in Iraq, the 26 years now of our jobs being outsourced and destroyed, the destruction of the American economy, the destruction of our infrastructure, our roads crumbling, our schools crumbling, all this stuff has woken the American people up.
I agree.
No president, no Democrat could take the presidency in the year 2009 when they're sworn in January 2009. No Democrat could take that presidency and not have to respond to us. Unlike Clinton, he never had to deal with us.
He did some wonderful things. I agree with you on that. But he also, on the back side of the dark side, he also done some bad things.
Yeah.
And we know that. So I cannot excuse what he had, the bad thing, and I have to accept the good thing also.
Brian, if you listen to the program regularly, I say Bill Clinton was the best Republican president we had since Dwight Eisenhower, you know. NAFTA, GATT were a disaster, the Telecommunications Act of 96, Glass-Steagall. I mean, there's just a whole variety of things that you can lay at Clinton's feet that I think are major disasters. The end of welfare as we know it, the end of big government as we know it. I mean, all of these things. But my point is that I really believe that even if Hillary wanted to govern as if she was Bill, that she can't because the times have changed.
She can't. And see, that's what we're confusing ourselves. Just like Barack Obama said, I'm running against two candidates. Who am I running against?
Yeah. Well,
I agree, what I'm saying is that he's a great president. And with all great due respect, he needs to sit down a bit.
Yeah.
He really needs to calm down just
absolutely
a bit because he's ruining his reputation for what he did to us, and he's not respecting us on that.
Brian, you're absolutely right. Today,
he's only there because we know him.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And thank you for the call and the comment. And in fact, Maureen Dowd wrote a great op-ed about this in today's New York Times. You know, basically making the point that I made on the air yesterday and the day before that Bill Clinton is not, he's sacrificing his legacy as a president. He's not acting presidential. He's acting like a campaign shill. He's playing the role of a vice president. The vice president's job is to be the hitman and then the vice presidential candidate. And then the presidential candidate's job is to be above the fray. And, you know, so, I mean, that's, you know, look at how Cheney and Bush played that. And that's what Bill Clinton is doing right now. And it's not presidential. It is wrong, frankly. And I think he needs to take a deep breath and sit down and shut up for a while. Or at least play the role of a supportive spouse rather than a hitman. Because it's wrong. Robert in New York City. Hey, Robert, you want to take me to task for something?
Yes. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
One second. I'm going to take you off the speaker.
Thank you.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Tom, I would like to challenge you on one question that you, one statement you had said. You had said that the big business using the laws in which we've written, and I believe that they circumventing the laws in order to for their benefit, because of the ambiguities, laws, and the English.
Yeah, well, here's where we probably agree, Robert. I would just slightly rephrase that. I would say instead of that these big transnational corporations are circumventing or circumnavigating the laws, I would say that they, through their lobbyists and through their political influence and all their money in Washington, D.C., are frankly writing the laws to their own benefit. And this is why you're seeing corporate tax rates, for example, dropping all over the world. You got cons running around right now saying, oh, the U.S. has the highest corporate tax rates in the world. Why is that? It's because transnational corporations have had such incredible power in every country on earth. There's been a coup, and nobody has noticed it. All the conservatives were worried about the U.N. all these years. Oh, we're going to give up sovereignty. We have given up sovereignty to the transnational corporations. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Well,
this is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Talk radio for the rest of us.
Ed, welcome back. Ben Shapiro is with us. His website, BenjaminShapiro.com. Nationally syndicated columnist, author of a new book Project President Bad Hair and Botox on the road to the White House. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
You know, in your book, you, for example, you, Calvin Coolidge, you say contemporary liberal historians find it difficult to understand the allure of President Calvin Coolidge. I thought the allure of him, you know, other, you know, he came into power when Harding died, and then he got reelected on his own, so he was president for 6 years, right up to 1929, was that he cut taxes for the very, very wealthy in this country 6 times, that he didn't say or do much beyond that, and that times seemed to be booming, just like they kind of seemed to be booming, over, you know, over the last 26 years under Reaganism. And, you know, in retrospect, you could argue that his policies led directly to the Republican Great Depression.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whatever his policies were, I think a large part of his allure actually was the image that he cultivated, because he cultivated this image as a tight-lipped but humorous guy. I mean, H.L. Mencken said that some people considered him to be the most typical American since Lincoln, and that's something that he really pushed. I mean, he, as tight-lipped and as uptight as he seemed, he was the kind of guy who would go out to his ranch in Vermont and have photographers take pictures of him in Indian headdress. He was the type of guy who would distribute stories about himself that showed him being, you know, very funny if taciturn. I mean, the most famous story, of course, is one where a woman approached him at a dinner party and said to him, "I'll bet you that I can get you to say more than 2 words." And he said, "You lose." So, yeah. I mean, he was a funny guy.
Yeah, he came back from
a likable guy.
Yeah, he came back from church, and his wife said, "You know, what was the sermon on?" And he said, "Sin." You know, he was Silent Cal. I mean, that's what he's known as.
And then his wife said, "What did the reverend say about sin?" He said, "He was against it."
Yeah. Now, you know, let's talk about the images of the candidates. I've read some of your columns over at townhall.com, William F. Buckley's conservative website. And in one of them, you're kind of handicapping the candidates on both sides. You say Clinton is a screeching, grating candidate who thrills no one and annoys virtually everyone. Obama is smooth and likable and, just as importantly, African-American, even if he spouts meaningless slogans that appeal to the fawning media elite. Say what?
Well, I think that if you look at what Obama largely says in his speeches, he talks about hope and change. He doesn't talk a lot of particulars. And when he does talk particulars, I think Clinton beats him on particulars. When it comes to, the image itself, you know, leaving aside the policy, I think that Obama beats her on image. I think that he made a big mistake in South Carolina, however, when he decided that he wanted to get down in the mud with her. By attacking her, he really took away his biggest advantage, and his biggest advantage was rising above the fray, looking like somebody who was, you know, a uniter and not a divider.
You mean when he called her a corporate lawyer, or pointed out that she'd been on the board of Walmart for, I think it was, 6 years?
Right, exactly, and then going after her and saying, you know, he didn't know who he was fighting, her husband. I mean, that's a big mistake. You want to attack Hillary, attack her all you want, but I think that the base still really likes Bill a lot. So, and the truth is that Hillary can afford to look mean, because everyone kind of assumes that she's mean. She's looked mean for a number of years already. So
mean or tough?
Well, I think that it's a very fine line for her. She tries to bring herself off as tough, but I think the problem for her is that in too many cases she's come off mean. Now I think she's really learning to walk that line pretty well. I think she found her stride in New Hampshire when she had that episode where she teared up over the direction of the country. Right. I mean, I thought that was, first of all, I thought it was genuine. And second of all, I thought that it was very good image politics, because it really softened her a lot. I mean, I think that she should take a page from Nancy Pelosi, frankly, and she should stop wearing as many frumpy pantsuits, you know, put on a skirt every so often, soften your hair, wear some pastels, and smile a little bit. And I think that now she's begun doing that, and I think that that's really redounded to her benefit. I mean,
you talk about Clinton and Obama here. I didn't see anything about John Edwards. Your thoughts on him as a candidate?
You know, John Edwards, I was shocked that he didn't do better in this campaign. I thought that he was, you know, a pretty strong image candidate.
Well, there's been a virtual media blackout on him ever since he's called for the breakup of the big media.
Exactly.
Like, that doesn't help.
I mean, I think that the truth is, I think that Obama's presence in the race kind of sucked all the air out of the room for Edwards, because Edwards, you know, takes a lot of the same positions that Obama has, he's a very good...
Actually, it's the other way around. Obama, Edwards lays out a health care policy. A couple of weeks later, Obama has that health care policy.
I think that's right. I think that Edwards has been the leader on the... you're right. I mean, I think Edwards has been the leader on those policies, and Obama has kind of taken them. But at the same time, Edwards' biggest problem, I think, in terms of image for a general election, would be this kind of metrosexual feel that he's put out there. I mean, if there's one moment in his campaign that's really crippled him, it happened back in 2004 when there was that video that popped up on YouTube where he was, they're having his hair done before the camera, and he whips out a compact and a comb, starts redoing his hair for a full 2 minutes, and someone pipes in, "I feel pretty" from West Side Story in the background. Right. I mean, that was pretty crippling.
Right, and that would be the Republican ad that they'd run against him.
Exactly.
And also you point out in your book, the tall candidate always wins, and he's average height, but Barack Obama is a very tall guy.
I mean, I think that Hillary could break the mold on that one, though, because I think that Hillary is most successful as a candidate, actually, when she plays the victim. I mean, that's true historically. She saw her best popularity ratings during the 1990s during the Lewinsky scandal.
Your comments on Hillary Clinton had to do with how she looks. And this is one of the concerns that I have. I mean, this is basically a very sexist perspective. At least in everything that you wrote. Well, you were writing about Mike Huckabee's friendly smile, but you don't talk about that they should ditch the pantsuits, or that they should change their appearance, or their hair, or the kind of clothes that they're wearing. You know, how do we get past this kind of sexist language and perceptions in politics, Ben?
I mean, I think that it's difficult to get past it simply because it remains an issue for most Americans. I mean, how people cultivate their image is going to be different for women than it is for men. And she's really the first serious female candidate for presidency of the United States that we've had. So this is something that commentators are just going to have to deal with. But, I mean, to be fair, I go after Mitt Romney on his hair. I mean, I talk about how John McCain should get better fitted clothes. I mean,
That's right. You said that Mitt Romney is so slick that he turns people off.
He looks
so perfect.
Exactly. I mean, Mitt Romney ought to muss up his hair a little bit, get in a pair of jeans and dig a hole somewhere and have people take pictures because he seems so suity. I mean, in Project President, I talk about the idea of suits versus boots, and the idea that Americans generally like cowboy candidates who own ranches, and that, whether it's Clinton or Bush. When it comes to Mitt Romney, this is the kind of guy who joked on Jay Leno that he changes from a dark suit into a light suit when he goes to bed at night. I mean, that's not the type of candidate who's going to attract people.
Yeah, I'm assuming that your loyalties, as it were, are on the Republican side. I'm curious who your favorite Republican candidates are, and if you want to handicap that race.
In terms of my personal preference, I mean, I like Rudy Giuliani, but as an image politician, he's been a disaster. I mean,
the guy's had three wives. He's been thrown out of the Catholic Church, unless he's.
Yeah, I mean, he's had so many gaffes already, and the YouTube videos of him, essentially making out with Donald Trump are not going to help him very much.
Well, in exchange for a $100,000 campaign contribution, he cited against the advice of all of his advisors, he cited the disaster headquarters for New York City and the World Trade Center after it had been bombed.
Right.
And so, when he was running down the streets in New York, that iconic video that he would no doubt use in a campaign commercial, he was running down the streets because he didn't have any place to go.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of questions about his leadership.
So why do you like Giuliani?
He, on a personal level, I mean, I like Giuliani.
No, I mean, why would you vote for him? You said he's your favorite Republican candidate.
I mean,
why?
I would vote for him because, I mean, I like his policies on tax cut, because I like his policies on foreign policy, because I think that he's tough and that he doesn't really care what other people think, which is something that I think actually most Americans like in a candidate, whether that's a Democrat or a Republican. You don't want somebody who bends with the wind.
Giuliani doesn't bend with the wind, but he used to be in favor of abortion. Now he's opposed to it. He used to be in favor of gay marriage. Now he's opposed to it. He used to be, a social moderate. Now he's a social right winger. He used to be, in favor of gun control. Now he's opposed to it. I'm confused.
Right. Well, I mean, but as you noticed, the policies that I was citing that I like from him are the ones where he didn't flip. So where he flipped. I like his new positions better than his old positions, but I would have voted for him even if he hadn't switched his position.
Do you think he has a chance?
I do. I think that he's either going to look like the smartest candidate in the world or the dumbest after Florida.
Yeah, yeah. And after Super Tuesday,
exactly.
As they go into that thing. Very, very interesting. And any thoughts on Grandpa Fred? I have here his speech yesterday when he was announcing that he was leaving. It continues for about a minute and a half. It's
it's hard to tell the difference there between Grandpa Fred and Grandpa Simpson. I think that Thompson's big problem, first of all, he jumped in too late, but second of all, the big rap on him was always that he didn't have the energy necessary, and he turned out to be Eeyore with narcolepsy.
Yeah, there you go. Ben Shapiro, BenjaminShapiro.com, his website, his book, Project President, Bad Hair and Botox on the Road to the White House. Ben, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
You're free as long as you don't say the wrong thing on the phone while the Attorney General's listening, or write the wrong letter while the FBI is reading your mail, or show up as a vet looking for veteran services and benefits as long as Republicans are running the VA. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Scott on the line with us. He is the founder, the editor, the chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org. Keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to, and you're doing a fine job of it, Larry. Welcome to the program.
Thank you much again, Tom. Yeah, it was what I did. It was a recess appointment. I appointed myself to keep an eye on the VA. So that way nobody can do anything about it.
There you go. You've been doing a marvelous job all these years.
Thank you.
VAWatchdog.org. What, in your mind, Larry, are the top stories of the day with regard to veterans?
Well, let's just start with more money. The VA budget went up $2.9 billion. That was for VA health care. And then Congress...
Now, hang on just a second. $2.9 billion, that's what, about 4 days in Iraq?
Yeah, something like
but
that.
But this is for an entire year for veterans.
Yes. Yeah. And then they also sneaked in an extra $3.7 billion for veterans' health care that they put in as emergency contingent funding. And they did it that way and sent it to the president's desk because President Bush already said, no, that extra money you've already authorized is enough. If you send me any more, I'll veto it. So they didn't include it in the regular appropriations bill. They sent it up as emergency contingent funding at $3.7 billion. Hmm. What that means is they put the ball on the president's desk, and they said, okay, you either get to say yes or no to the veterans of America. It's entirely up to you. There was a tremendous amount of pressure from veterans and veterans groups, and the president did release the extra $3.7 billion for VA health care this year, much of that going for mental health needs, suicide prevention, post-traumatic stress disorder counseling, traumatic brain injury research. Beg your pardon?
I'll bet he really had to just grit his teeth on that one. I mean, that's coming right out of tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires.
There are two things we have to look at. One, it's an election year, and there was a lot of Republican pressure on the president to release this money. The Republicans up for re-election didn't want to have to go to the veterans groups and say, well, I don't know why the president withheld the money. The other one is there was quid pro quo here. We don't know what it was, but remember, George W. Bush doesn't give away anything. So there was a deal made somewhere, so he released the funds. We'll probably find that out down the road. But the good news is the VA now has close to adequate funding for this year, much more than they'd anticipated, and a lot of good programs are going to be the result of it. And the hiring frenzy is already on. So that's excellent. Hiring.
Larry, is anybody taking any initiative on the idea of making VA funding not discretionary? Making it just absolute, you know, this is the way it's going to be, guys. This is, you know, sort of like Social Security is.
Mandatory funding for VA healthcare, because right now, as we've discussed, it's part of the discretionary budget. It is still on the table in the House and the Senate. It's in committee. They are discussing it. They're meeting about it. I have a feeling we will not see that as a major issue this year because it really won't be able to be accomplished without a tax increase. Quite frankly, it's going to be extremely costly. And to mandate that funding, there's going to have to be a way to pay for it. And the only way to pay for it is that new revenue stream, as they call it. That's taxes. The Democrats right now, as you know, are aiming at the White House. They don't want to talk about taxes. Should there be a Democratic victory, okay, in the elections and the Democrats take over the White House, I expect to see mandatory funding within a year after that.
Yeah. And this is just a kind of a quick one, and it's almost a little off topic, but the result of research at the Veterans Administration, this great little two-sentence quote on your homepage there at VAWatchdog.org, it's a revelation. A little bit of
VA research, getting in shape reduces death risk.
Yeah, 30 minutes a day. Simple. 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week of brisk walking will reduce your risk of dying by 50% or more.
If not more. Now, this is something that the average guy would assume. Okay, if I exercise, I'm going to be in better shape, and that means I'll probably live longer. But the first people really to give it true numbers, the research was done at the VA. And because we had this huge base of people to study, which is just marvelous, over 15,000 veterans took part in this research, and they found even as little as 10 minutes a day can make a difference in mortality. And we're not talking going to the gym and pumping up on the machines. We're talking very simple aerobic exercises, such as walking up and down your street. Start at 10 minutes, move up to 15. 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, and you can increase your risk of mortality drops by about 50%. And this goes for all ages, and it goes across all ethnicities as well.
Yeah, use it or lose it.
It's marvelous, and it's just the proof we've been looking for that says, hey, exercise is a great thing.
Yeah, it's just simple walking, you know, what our bodies are designed for. We have about a half a minute. Any other things here you want to mention very quickly?
Just one thing, and that is if any of your listeners, Tom, have questions about VA benefits or VA claims, please contact us at VAWatchdog.org. We have the world's best veterans advocate, and that is Jim Strickland, who retired as an executive from the private health care industry and has now become literally the country's expert on filing VA claims. We offer that absolutely free of charge. If people have any question about themselves, a friend, a family member, just come to VAWatchdog.org. We'll connect you with Jim Strickland. You will get your answers.
That's a marvelous resource. Thank you. Larry Scott, editor-in-chief, chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org. Check it out. Larry, thanks so much for being with us.
Tom, thank you.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Mr. Mukasey is still, as they say over at the Center for American Progress, at Think Progress, that are tap dancing about whether waterboarding is torture. This administration, you know what? I don't know why somebody in the media doesn't just come out and say this. You know, this simple truth, that if anybody in this administration were to say what John McCain says, if anybody who has legal authority were to say that waterboarding is torture, like, for example, the Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, if he was to say, yeah, it's torture, then immediately he'd have to start prosecuting George Bush, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, the whole bunch of them, Alberto Gonzalez, Mr. Yee. I mean, all of these guys who were in on this thing of let's torture these guys, we'd have to throw their butts in jail. And they're just not going to allow that to happen. Also, just, you know, FYI, the president, the resident, Mr. Bush, the guy who was put into office by the Supreme Court and reaffirmed there by fraud in Ohio, Mr. Bush, vetoed the Children's Health Insurance Program. You'll recall that a month or so ago. The House tried to override the veto. They fell 15 votes short. They needed a two-thirds majority. 15 votes short. Representative Steve King, the Republican from Iowa, called this a victory for kids and taxpayers. My message to Representative King, you are scum. You know, I very rarely use that kind of language. But anybody who would, any fool who would say that vetoing the state children's health insurance program is a victory for kids does not deserve to be in the United States House of Representatives, does not have the intelligence to be, or the moral compass, the moral reality to be in the United States House of Representatives. It's pathetic. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, our blog and our message board, also at AirAmerica.com. And let's see here. Shirley in Warren, Michigan. Shirley, thanks for holding on so long. What's up?
Well, you know, hi, Tom. I'm really upset when people call Bush stupid. That's a compliment. When you lie, you know you're lying. That's not stupid. It's evil.
Yeah.
When the lie you tell causes death and injury, you are evil.
Yeah, Shirley, I have never called George Bush stupid. And the point that I make is that thank you for your comment, is that I think we do all of ourselves a great disservice in this country, a great disservice by thinking that he's stupid. He's not a stupid man. He's inarticulate in some areas. He's very articulate when it comes to death, destruction, and punishment, by the way. If he talks about those issues, he has a golden tongue. But he is broadly inarticulate when it comes to the founding values of this country. But no, he is not stupid. He's therefore all the more dangerous. Mark in Laramie, New Mexico. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. I agree with the caller just before me. And in fact, there's an article in the Santa Fe New Mexican today that says that two nonprofit journalism organizations found Bush and top administration officials issued hundreds of false statements about national security threat from Iraq in the 2 years following the 201 terrorist attacks.
Yeah.
The number is 935 false statements.
Yeah.
And don't you think that something like this should be part of the impeachment process?
I do. I absolutely do. And in fact, I have the article here. It's part of every day I end up at the end of the show with a huge stack of news that I never got to. it's part of my stack of stuff. But I think that, you know, you go back and you look at some of the things that Bush said. I mean, these were just plain old flat out lies. He just comes out and says,
facing clear evidence of peril.
Yeah.
We cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Or here's another one.
First, some ask why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
I mean, he knew these were things were lies. And, you know, yes, over 900 lies.
It's horrible. But on a happier note, your story about your poor kitty cat that got under the hood.
Right.
A few years ago, I live in a little village in New Mexico, south of Santa Fe, of about 200 people. And all we have is a train station for Amtrak and an 1880s saloon where I worked for many years. One day I went down, and as soon as I turned off parked my truck and turned off the engine, one of my hens came flying out like a rocket from underneath my truck hood.
From the hood.
And she was freaked, just like your cat was. And yeah. I chased her around for a little while. And finally I realized one guy is not going to catch a freaked out hen.
You're right.
And these are Dutch Hamburgs, and they can really fly like a bird.
Yeah.
So I went into the saloon, and to my luck, there was a family of four that had just sat down to dinner, and they had about an 11-year-old boy and maybe a 13-year-old girl, and I asked their parents if I could borrow them to help me catch my hen. And they said, oh, sure. So they came out with me, and there was an adobe wall out there about 6 feet high, so if you got on one side, the chicken would just go on the other side. So I put the boy on one side, and the girl and I went on the other side, and we got the hen up into a tree. And so I said to the boy, just grab her by the feet and hold her upside down.
Uh-huh.
And he looked at me and said, what? And you know, if you've ever looked at a chicken foot, it looks like a hawk's talons.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
pretty scary.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the nearest this kid had ever been to a chicken was at Colonel Sanders. But he took a deep breath, and he reached up, and he grabbed the chicken and held him upside down. And I don't know if you know, but if you hold a chicken upside down, they go limp.
Right.
So I took the chicken, and we walked into the restaurant with the chicken,
That's
with
crazy.
His wings hanging down, or her wings hanging down.
Yeah.
And I thanked the parents very much. And so I took the hen back to my house, which is close to the place, and brought them a dozen of my free-range chicken eggs, and thanked them very much.
What a great all-American story, Mark. You know, can I borrow your kids to help catch my hen? And they said yes. That's the America that we all want, you know?
Yeah.
The America where we help each other out, where we're not afraid of each other, where we're not all living in fear, where it's not 24 hours a day on TV of weird predators on reality shows and stuff. And, you know, yeah, it's Mark, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you, Tom.
Great. Good talking with you. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today? Steve,
Tom,
you're on the air.
Yeah, I had a thought. I was thinking about your guest last hour, Robert Perry, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me like that conservative policies are an attempt to hollow out government, move us towards some kind of a voluntary type of society where there's hardly any obligations or duties, and where it seems like some people have, whether they're individuals or businesses, have a natural advantage over other people. They're valued more, and they ultimately end up taking advantage and exploiting people in society. And, you know,
yeah, I think the conservative philosophy can be boiled down to the phrase, "I got mine, screw you." You know,
right. That's the title of your book, right?
Yeah. Well, the title of the book is "Screw the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class." Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think everybody should read that book. Boy, that was a winner.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
On Iraq War, I wanted to ask you also: is there any connection with the Francis Fukuyama's book that he'd come out in 1989 and 1992, where he wrote about the end of history?
And the last man, yeah.
Right.
Francis Fukuyama was one of the seminal thinkers of the modern neocon movement in that he suggested that and pointed out that no two nations who were democracies had ever gone to war against each other, and therefore if we could convert everybody in the world to democracy, the world would be at peace. And this was, you know, a very seductive and very pleasant-sounding thing. I mean, I actually wrote about it in What Would Jefferson Do? In one of my books, quoting some of his research. And the problem is that the neocons then took this very nice, rational idea that actually had a historical and reality-based grounding and said, so let's just push democracy down people's throats with the barrel of a gun, particularly where there's a lot of oil. And, you know, it didn't work out quite that way. Fukuyama has since repudiated the neoconservatives. But, but yeah, I think, you know, he has since said, you know, I'm not part of that movement anymore. Sorry, guys. Although much of his research still stands intact. But he's, I think, these days rather, I can't speak for him, but I think he's rather horrified by the way that it's been used. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. George in Van Nuys, California. Hey, George.
Yeah, I want to talk about the Reagan legacy. Besides raising the public school tuitions and closing the mental institutions, he left us with a $3 trillion deficit. He put 40 million people in the poverty level. There were 1,700 savings and loans go bankrupt, and 500 banks that cost the taxpayer over $500 million to bail them out. There were 5 million personal bankruptcies. Thousands of corporations went bankrupt because he instituted accelerated depreciation. There were millions of home foreclosures, as there is today. Bush is following his legacy. He privatized the government, costing taxpayers billions of dollars over the cost of what governments would do business for.
You're absolutely right. And, George, this year, you and I are going to pay an average of around $1,000 per family, $300 billion in total, in taxes to pay the interest on the money that Reagan borrowed that still hasn't been paid back. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
So now we're a nation at permanent war. I can't help but wonder just what it's all for. Are we killing for freedom, or is freedom what's died? You should know the answer if God's on our side.
Yeah, you'd think so. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman Program. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, including the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, believing that keeping our families healthy should be a right of living in these here United States, not a privilege for the privileged few. Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. On the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Lots go
going on. Let's first talk about the Israeli-Hamas situation before we go anywhere else. In terms of the Hamas situation, Dana...
You're talking about the wall to Egypt getting knocked down.
That's right. And somebody said at the White House, well, things are getting better. And Dana Perino did a double take and said, I don't think so. And then she was asked about Hamas, and she said, we don't talk about Hamas. So won't answer anything directly about Hamas.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, I just report the news. What can I say?
Yeah.
A lot...
Well, and I kvetch about it. You know,
so. Right. A lot of interesting questions came up today around the financial situation. There was a forum this morning at the New America Foundation, and the Edwards person, Obama person, McCain person, and Hillary Clinton's person talked about their economic stimulus packages. It was interesting that the McCain person said, and he was the only one to say this, that the U.S. government is $50 to $60 trillion short of obligations, such as Social Security and other obligations.
Right, he's using David Walker's numbers, the U.S. Comptroller General.
Oh, right. But it's interesting that the other people are not necessarily talking about it. Hillary Clinton's person was the only one to say, if you raise taxes of those making more than $250,000 a year, you still have a great economy.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, Ellen. David Walker is right, and John McCain is right, that we're $50 to $60 trillion behind on our obligations. If, however, you did away with the cap on Social Security so that Bill Gates is paying the exact same amount in his income taxes in Social Security that you and I are paying, just the exact same rate, flat rate, if you did away with that cap, that $50 to $60 trillion shortfall that we have would become probably about a $20 or $30 trillion surplus overnight. And we're talking about over a 40 or 50-year time horizon. So, David Walker's right. His solution is do away with Social Security. I think a much simpler solution is to say, hey, you know, right now, if you make more than $97,000 a year, you don't pay a penny in Social Security taxes after that. And why not make people who are paying, who are making $1 million a year, who are making $5 million a year, who are making $50 million a year, why not have them pay Social Security taxes like the average working person?
A very good question.
But it's not a question you're going to hear from the McCain camp, because they're using the right-wing talking points, which presume that you're going to, nuke Social Security, basically.
Well, for sure. And one of the other things McCain said, and actually I talked about it on your your Portland station, and they said to ask you about this, because I said to them, I haven't done the checking. But, but the issue is does the United States, as McCain people claim, pay more corporate income tax than any other country?
I doubt that that's the way he phrased it. He probably said that we have the highest corporate income tax rate at 35%.
That's right. Exactly.
And the reality is that at 35%, we have one of the higher rates in the world. I'm not sure if it's the highest, but it certainly is one of the higher ones. Whether corporations pay more taxes in the United States, no, they don't. Corporations pay much
because
higher taxes.
Because of all the deductibles.
Right. There's just a million loopholes. I forget the number, but I think it's around 90% of all corporations in America pay no taxes. It's a joke. The corporate tax in the United States is an absolute joke. You'll recall the first year of the Bush administration. I mean, Enron went not for 4 years. Not only did they not pay any taxes, but they got a $400 million tax rebate on money that they had never even paid in as taxes. So we've got a tax system for the corporations here in the United States.
Okay, well,
I knew
there was something funny, so I decided to ask you about that.
Well, and the other thing that the other thing that it's a testimony to is that it used to be that around the world, our corporate tax rate used to be around 50% during the Eisenhower years. And it was, frankly, right up to Reagan, more or less. And corporations shouldered about half of the total tax burden in the United States. They paid half the cost of the commons, of the schools and the courts and the police and the fire and everything else that the corporations use, just like you and I use. Now they pay about 8%, between 7 and 9%, depending on whose numbers you're using, of that total. They used to pay about half of it. In the rest of the world, they're still paying about half of it, because the loopholes have been closed up. So when they talk about, who's paying the taxes, who's paying the taxes is you and me. And those taxes have been shifted mostly to the middle class, which is why the middle class, when somebody says, hey, lower taxes, the middle class say, yeah, please. And the best way to lower them is to put them back where they should be. Let's all pay them fairly. Pardon my rant.
Okay. But also, the CBO said today that the deficit is going to increase 34% to $219 billion this year, and that just number came out today.
Yeah, that's because of a slowdown in economic activity because of the...
But we're not in a recession. We are in a slowdown.
Right, yeah, because of the assumed... slide.
Now, what's very interesting is what's happening as Hillary and other people are talking about green jobs. It looks as if the conservatives, such as Competitive Enterprise Institute, et cetera, are saying, if you go green, you're going to even cause more jobs. This is not a time to do it.
You're going to lose more jobs?
That's what they're saying.
Oh, man. What are they smoking? In any case, yeah, you just report the news. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Always great to have you on. 57 minutes. Well, actually, it's the end of the show here. Tomorrow I'll be challenging conservative Gabriel Ross on why what he calls the nanny state won't give up road construction and hand it over to private businesses. Stephen Marks here on his book, Confessions of a Political Hitman. Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.